Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, February 16th, 2026 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor's column, and then I'll do On the Cover, followed by Our World, and then Reporters on the Job, The Explainer, The Home Forum, and Editorials. So getting right into it, the From the Editor's column is entitled Going Beyond Black and White Narratives. This is written by Stephanie Haynes, who's the print editor, and you can email her at haness@csmonitor.com. And she writes, when my teenage daughters heard that we were running a story this week on families embracing landline phones, they had some clear instructions. Make sure, they told me, to show that this trend is not for just for little kids whose parents don't want them to have actual phones. After all, my 13-year-old has a cell phone, albeit one that doesn't let her go online or on social media. But one of her favorite gifts this past holiday season was a flashback phone from the brand Tin Can, a pink replica of the 1980s landline once attached to the wall of my mother's kitchen. And shout out to Deputy National News Editor Chelsea Sheasley, who told me about Tin Can after she investigated it for her kids. Lydia loves this stationary phone. So do her friends. She loves the ring. She likes writing out her family's and family members' phone numbers in pencil on paper. She enjoys slamming a phone down in mock hang-up drama. And she seems to revel in the art of sitting in one place, twirling the cord and talking for hours. All of which would seem odd to me if I didn't remember doing the same when Nirvana wasn't retro. Why? The answer is all about fun, not fear. Plenty has been written about the dangers of social media. Indeed, as Victoria Hoffman's story on page 38 mentions, a slew of lawsuits this year will detail those concerns in court. But along with a growing movement of parents mobilizing to protect their children, young people are themselves taking control of and interacting with tech in a way that feels right. This might mean leaving smartphones behind and picking up a landline instead, because it turns out focus can be more enjoyable than distraction. Or it could mean using those smartphones for deeper purposes such as videotaping protests or monitoring elections. Monitor journalists this week contributed from around the world for our story about residents fighting back against government efforts to block communication, an effort largely led by younger citizens. Technology, like so many things, is complex, which leads me to my girls' next instruction. They don't appear to have qualms about telling me how to do my job. Please don't run another "Everything is Bad About Phones" story, they said. We won't. We know that stories become more interesting, nuanced, and compelling when we take a wider view and avoid predictable, overly simplistic narratives. Often that means finding creativity and resilience, even on our most challenging subjects. And that was the From the Editor's column this week, written by Stephanie Haynes, who's the print editor, and it was entitled Going Beyond Black and White Narratives. And now for On the Cover. What happens when the internet goes dark? Recent blackouts in Iran, Uganda, and beyond highlight a new front emerging in conflicts around the world, the fight to stay online. Though governments hold most of the power, people are finding ways to push back. And this is written by a whole slew of people. Ryan Lenora Brown and Whitney Ulick, who are special correspondents, and Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer, and Valentina Gill, Sophie Nyman, and Akash Hassan, who are special contributors. From Johannesburg, Mexico City, London, Caracas, Venezuela, Kampala, Uganda, and Delhi. After the January 3rd ouster of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, paramilitary groups loyal to the deposed leader's political movement began randomly stopping people on the streets of the capital, Caracas. They were searching for a type of contraband notoriously common in Venezuela, a virtual private network, or VPN. Often installed as software on a cell phone, a VPN masks a user's location, allowing that person to bypass government restrictions that keep large swaths of the internet blocked here. It's a clear indicator of someone looking for information beyond what the government tells them is true, explains Iria Poyosa, a senior research fellow at the Atlantic Council's Democracy Plus Tech Initiative, who has lived and worked in Venezuela. Venezuela's paranoia about what its citizens might find and share online is not unique. In 2024, the most recent year for which data is available, there were 296 internet shutdowns in 54 countries, according to the watchdog Access Now. Most were implemented by the country's government or at authorities' behest. Experts agree these blackouts are becoming more frequent, but in recent weeks, as shutdowns have rocked countries from Uganda to Iran, a parallel trend is also clear. Citizens are fighting back. The digital front. For now, anyway, the state still has the edge. Internet shutdowns are an expression of power difference, explains Tony Roberts, co-editor of Internet Shutdowns in Africa, Technology, Rights, and Power. They can only be carried out by powerful people and people with less on people with less power. In nearly every country, the state either directly controls telecommunications infrastructure or regulates the private companies that do. That gives them almost unrestricted power to decide when the internet stays on or when it goes off. On January 8th, as 11 days of protests in Iran morphed into widespread calls for regime change, its government decided to flip the switch. At 8:30 p.m. local time, internet access plunged from nearly 100% connectivity into a total blackout, according to NetBlocks, which monitors internet freedom. Under the cover of this digital darkness, Iran's security forces moved in, massacring protesters. By the last week of January, 6,126 Iranians had been confirmed dead, with 17,091 possible additional fatalities still, quote, under investigation, close quote, according to the Washington-based human rights activist news agency, which has tabulated accurate casualty numbers in the past. Just days after the internet went off in Iran, Uganda's government announced it was also pulling the plug. On January 13th, 2 days before the country's presidential election, the Uganda Communications Commission ordered all mobile operators to shut off service. In a letter, the commission thanked operators for upholding national stability. But many observers saw a more nefarious aim, to sever the online ties between opposition candidate Robert Kayagululanya, better known as Bobby Wine, and his Generation Z base. A former pop star with a flair for online self-promotion, Mr. Wine, along with his team, has long used the internet to rally supporters in a context where, offline, opposition members are routinely harassed, beaten, and arrested. Young Ugandans aren't the only ones using the internet to mobilize. In 2025, Gen Z demonstrators used the internet to rattle the gates of power in Nepal, Morocco, Madagascar, Kenya, Togo, Georgia, and Peru, among others. Anger was fomented in Facebook groups and Discord servers spilled into the street. Crackdowns were fast, deadly, and often aided by the virtual tear gas of internet restrictions. Gen Z's fluency with digital tools has certainly reshaped how contemporary protest movements organize, mobilize, and communicate, says Tamiwa Ilori, a senior researcher at the Technology, Rights, and Investigations Divisions of Human Rights Watch. He says that while it is far from the only factor contributing to the rise of internet shutdowns, young protesters have helped governments understand the internet as critical infrastructure for activism. That perception has made internet shutdowns more attractive. Cost of a blackout. Some effects of internet shutdowns are obvious. In Iran, for instance, the slow return of connectivity in recent days has been accompanied by a torrent of photos and videos showing what the regime was able to do when no one was watching. Now that things are coming back on, people are scrambling to put together the puzzle pieces of the truth, explains Mahsa Elimardani, Associate Director of the Technology Threats and Opportunities Program at the New York-based human rights organization, Witness. Other effects of these blackouts are less immediately evident. In 2025, VPN industry watchdog Top 10 VPN estimated that internet blackouts cost the countries that implemented them a collective $19.7 billion. These economic hits come in a variety of forms. During Uganda's recent shutdown, for instance, people who keep their money in virtual wallets found themselves suddenly unable to buy food or take a motorcycle taxi to work. Meanwhile, in India, Nasir Mir still lives with the consequences of a 2019 internet shutdown in the Kashmiri city of Srinagar, where he ran a courier service. When he was suddenly unable to organize deliveries online, his business collapsed. Since then, he has sworn off online work. It felt like too much of a risk, he says. I lost confidence in running a business that depends on the internet. There was a personal toll, too. As the blackout stretched on, Mr. Mir couldn't speak to his brothers in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and the siblings couldn't reach him or their mother in Kashmir. For months, neither group knew if the other were safe. My mother cried nearly every day, he says. Shifting playing field. As internet censorship and shutdowns become more frequent, citizens are fighting back. The classic tool is a VPN like the ones used by many Venezuelans. When governments block access to particular corners of the internet, such as social media services, VPNs allow netizens to play a game of internet whack-a-mole, disappearing from local servers and popping up virtually somewhere else in the world. But when the entire internet goes down, so do VPNs. For a long time, that left most information seekers with one decidedly low-tech option. I kept myself informed by standing at my window, explains J.V., a resident of Caracas, describing how he followed the aftermath of Venezuela's 2024 election. The monitor is not using his full name for his security, as government repression has increased in the wake of Mr. Maduro's capture. Now, offline messaging services like BitChat, which operates over Bluetooth, and satellite internet services like Elon Musk's Starlink provide more modern alternatives. During the Iranian protests, this was a game changer, Ms. Ella Mardani explains. A few days into the internet blackout, Starlink began providing services free of charge inside Iran, even though this service is illegal. Activists say the government succeeded in disrupting Starlink signals for the first 28 to 48 hours of the crackdown, which they believe was carried out with technology from Russia. But there are about 50,000 smuggled units operating inside the country, and they were able to beam out images showing scenes of overwhelmed morgues and police firing live rounds into crowds of demonstrators. But satellite internet isn't a free-for-all. For instance, in India, which has the dubious distinction of being the country with the most internet shutdowns in the world, government regulators have dragged their feet in negotiations to allow Starlink to operate there. Security requirements top the list of sticking points, says Arpar Gupta, co-founder of the Internet Freedom Foundation, an Indian advocacy group. In other words, Delhi wants to know that Starlink will comply with its internet shutoff orders, he says. Services like Starlink also have their own gatekeepers. For example, while Mr. Musk's company was quick to make services free to Iranian protesters, the world's richest man was silent on the Ugandan government's suspension of Starlink ahead of the election there. If Starlink devices make it into India and Uganda, the company doesn't need government permission to turn them on. But for Mr. Musk, the business costs of angering these governments might outweigh the benefits of providing Starlink service. What we have seen is that this tool remains under the control and whims of owners and those who influence them from one hand, and local governments who are finding ways to jam this service from the other, wrote Hannah Crichton, Director of Internet Technology and Development at the Internet Society, an advocacy organization via a messaging app. Still, at least some of those doing the jamming appear worried about the future. In late January, Abulhassan Firouzabadi, the former secretary of Iran's Supreme Council of Cyberspace, told Iranian media that his government's ability to control protests by turning off the web had a clear expiration date, one or two more years. Unfortunately, internet shutdowns will soon be obsolete, he said. And we have a second article in the On the Cover section, and it's entitled, Off Like a Light Switch. On the eve of elections, the Ugandan government turned off the internet. Journalists kept working. This is written by Sophie Aniemann, who is a contributor. From Kampala, Uganda, at exactly 6 p.m. on January 13th, 2 days before Uganda's presidential and parliamentary elections, the internet turned off like a light switch. I was expecting the blackout. The government of President Yoweri Museveni, who has ruled Uganda for the past 4 decades, also suspended web services during the last elections in 2021 and blocked social media in 2016. But although I was prepared for the internet to go off, the reality of it was startling. I felt as though I were looking at the world around me through a veil of fog, only able to see as far as my hands in front of me. As a journalist, I was suddenly unable to do research or file stories. On a personal level, I was cut off from my family and friends outside Uganda. I'd simply have to find a way to do my job. An eerie quiet. The next morning, I headed to one place I thought I might still be able to get online, a Kampala hotel frequented by government elites. I was nervous. A young white woman in jeans and a t-shirt, I was a conspicuous presence. I worried I was being watched. I responded to emails from my editors and then left as quickly as I could. When the polls opened on the morning of January 15th, the internet still hadn't returned. Armored tanks rolled down streets, usually lined with cars and fruit vendors. Neighborhoods that typically buzzed with good morning greetings and the sermons of roadside preachers was so quiet that I could hear the trill of birdsong. On the back of a motorbike, I rushed down roads littered with people with purple jacaranda flowers and torn-up pieces of campaign posters. At polling stations, I scribbled notes into my notebook before feeding them to editors over a shaky phone line. My fellow journalists and I helped one another as much as we could, sharing tips and information, speculating about where we might be able to get online, and calling to ensure colleagues had returned home safely. I felt bolstered by this support, but it did not take away fear entirely. Freedom comes with responsibility. In the days that followed, there were rumors of arrests and deaths, but without the internet, there was little way to verify anything I heard. Normally, I would be able to scour social media posts and videos. I could not do that now. Uncertainty continued to mount. When the camp of opposition candidates Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobby Wine, claimed that he had been abducted in an army helicopter, colleagues and I telephoned each other trying to piece together what had really happened. Then the story abruptly changed. Mr. Wine said his house had been raided and he had gone into hiding. Weeks later, his exact location remained unclear. On January 17th, 2 days after the vote, the result was announced. Mr. Museveni had handily won a 7th term. The next day, the internet returned. But at a press conference soon after, Uganda Communications Commission Executive Director George William Dayambi Thembo announced that social media would remain restricted. Freedom comes with responsibility, he warned. I left the press conference still thinking over his words. My phone was not working unless I used a Wi-Fi connection, and even then the network was weak. I headed back home to check my messages, thinking about just how fragile my link to the internet was, and with it, the world beyond Uganda, and how quickly it could be taken away. Also included in the On the Cover section is a graphic explainer, and I'll do my best to convey what is graphically showing us here, but there is some text, first of all. When digital information ceases to flow. For those in power, internet shutdowns can be a powerful tool to control the spread of information, make organizing more difficult, and silence and isolate opposition. As more activity shifts to the internet, the consequences can be severe. Internet shutdowns can take many forms, including heavy-handed approaches such as damaging or cutting power to information infrastructure, as well as subtler approaches such as redirecting internet traffic to government-controlled systems or censoring the information being sent to users' devices. Internet shutdowns are a constant game of cat and mouse. According to internet access watchdog AccessNow, 2024 was a record year for internet shutdowns, many coinciding with elections and protests. As shutdowns become more common, those looking to circumvent government controls are turning to technologies such as virtual private networks, or VPNs, and satellite internet. Okay, the first piece of this graphic here is it shows internet shutdowns in 2024 by country. It shows a map of the world, and there are dots, orange dots, in countries showing that they had a shutdown. And only some of them tell how many because the dots are really big. So here we go. There was absolutely nothing in North America, including Canada, and nothing in Greenland, nothing in Mexico, but in the Caribbean, I think that's Cuba, they did. And there's somebody in Middle America, but I don't know who. South America, there's two countries, but they don't label which ones they are. But move on over to Africa. At least half the countries have had internet shut down. Palestinian territories had 6, Ukraine had 7, Russia had 13, Pakistan had 21, Bangladesh had 5, and Myanmar had 85, and India had 84. And some of these totals include shutdowns imposed from outside the country. Here's our next graphic. It's a graph, and it says shutdowns are on the rise, and the vertical column is a number that goes from 0 to, that's the y-axis, 0 to 300, and x-axis goes from the year 2016 through 2024. So in 2016, there were approximately, and this is worldwide, in 2016, there was approximately, looks like 80 shutdowns and about 25 countries affected. In 2017, there was over 100, maybe 110 shutdowns of the internet, and less countries were affected than the previous year. In 2018, there was about 200 internet shutdowns, and the countries affected was about the same as the first year, not many. And in 2019, there was about, looks like about 220, I'm guessing, internet shutdowns, and maybe about 35, 40 countries affected. In 2020, shutdowns went down. There were about, looks like about 170. And the countries affected were probably around 35 or so. 2021, the internet shutdowns went back up to just under 200, with maybe 35 or 40 countries affected. 2022, a little over 200 shutdowns, and the countries affected was a little bit more than the previous year. 2023, same amount of countries affected, but the shutdowns went up to like 280. And in 2024, the numbers of countries affected in the shutdowns was pushing 45 to 50, and the internet shutdowns zoomed up to about 300. And, oh, the source for all this is AccessNow and Jacob Turcotte, who is a staff writer. And he might have done the graphics. They don't say that this time. Anyway, the third and final part of this graphic is a cat and mouse game. They show something they call Open Internet Global Communications Network and satellite internet providers, and showing the signal trying to get to a country. And it says here, satellite internet providers, it says because satellite internet doesn't depend on local communications infrastructure, it can only be interrupted by overwhelming radio frequencies locally. And so they jam the signal. For the Open Internet Global Communications Network, there's a national internet gateway that can be open or closed. And if it's closed, you can't get out. Nobody can get in. But they do, it says, national intranet. Some governments have set up walled gardens in which communications can be monitored, controlled, or shut down altogether. And then it does show a VPN, a little computer and a monitor, and they have a path through the internet gateway because they're using a VPN, which is a virtual private network. Shutdowns or filters may be circumvented through encrypted connections unreadable by authorities. But if the entire network is shut down, VPNs won't work. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for Our World in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is self-described. It says a global news roundup compiled by the Monitor's international team. And there's what, 1, 2, 3, 4 little things compiled. Here we are. The first one, train tracks across the Sahara. After braving the Saharan heat for 2 years, Chinese and Algerian construction workers have installed tracks for Africa's first heavy freight desert railway in the continent's largest country. As part of China's Belt and Road Initiative, a China-owned construction group built 575 kilometers, or about 358 miles, of the 950-kilometer railway, the largest infrastructure project by a Chinese firm in Algeria, according to Business Insider Africa. It will be used in part to connect Algeria's Gare de Jabalé iron reserve with the rest of the country. That was by Audrey Thibert, who's a staff writer. Our next one, I want to show the world what Africa is. That's what American YouTube star Darren Watkins Jr., a.k.a. Isho Speed, declared during his recent whistle-stop tour of the continent. In one frenetic month, the influencer's more than 50 million subscribers watched as he worked as a mascot at the Africa Cup of Nations final in Morocco, received a new name in Ghana, and raced a cheetah in South Africa. While some criticized the tour as a money-making gimmick, many praised the star for telling joyful stories about Africa. And that was written by Ryan Lenora Brown, who's a special correspondent. The next one. If you come after Canada, you are going to have the world coming after you, even more than Greenland. That was retired Canadian Major General David Fraser told the Globe and Mail this in late January. U.S. President Donald Trump's remarks in 2025 about wanting to annex Canada prompted its military to draw up models of how it might respond. While defense officials believe the chances of an invasion are remote, the modeling is thought to be the first of its kind in more than a century. That was written by Sarah Miller Lana, who is the deputy international editor. And the last one here, now airing, Confessions of Corruption. As Chinese leader Xi Jinping purges top generals, a move officially aimed at rooting out corruption, the propaganda apparatus has filled the airwaves with an anti-corruption documentary series. Similar to a U.S. true crime television show, the series includes disgraced officials confessing to graft and voicing regret. In the third episode, former Hubei Province Communist Party Secretary Jiang Chaoliang says he allowed a businessman to pay for his children's education, buy his nanny an apartment, and every Chinese New Year gave his mother 20,000 yuan, that's about $2,878, in small bills for her mahjong games, according to a report in a series in the state-run Global Times. And that was written by Ann Scott Tyson, who is a staff writer. And now for Reporters on the Job in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is a map of the world, and countries where reporters are reporting from are highlighted in some sort of orange-brown, and the rest of the world is blue. So the first one is from Washington, D.C., and it's written by Sophie Hills. Reporters often face split-second decisions about how to engage. On January 24th, I watched a group of people brave frigid weather to hold a prayer vigil outside the headquarters of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. As they prayed, my phone buzzed. Alex Preti had been killed in Minneapolis. Should I tell someone? At a political rally, I would have asked for reactions, but that day, it felt intrusive. I hovered at the periphery as the group recited the Hail Mary. Afterward, I talked to a man who knew that Mr. Pretty had been shot. As tears ran down his cheeks from the cold, he explained that he had been arrested before for nonviolent civil disobedience. His intent, he told me, was to uphold those laws which support human life. The next one is from Brussels, and Anna Maureen Grobe has written this, and here's what she wrote. I have a soft spot in my heart for Stars and Stripes. The newspaper published the first piece I wrote when I was in 12th grade, living on a U.S. military base in Germany. Years later, in December of 2011, I met the newspaper's editor-in-chief, Eric Slavin, when we were in Iraq to witness the end of America's war there. I had covered the war since 2006 from a makeshift Marine Corps base in an old factory near Fallujah and to the lush province of Diyala that became known for roadside bombings, to a palace in Baghdad converted into a U.S. military guest house. I flew on the U.S. military's last plane out of Iraq. Back home in Brussels, I caught up with Eric for a monitor story about changes facing the newspaper. Now from London, we've got Scott Peterson writes something. Despite my passport from the United States, the Great Satan in Iran's official lexicon, I have made 45 reporting trips to Iran over the past 30 years and wrote a book about the ever-fascinating Islamic Republic. But my latest Iran visa requests, one was ready just as Israel began bombing Iran in June. In January, another request was overtaken by nationwide protests that grew into a regime challenge and unprecedented crackdown. Like many foreign correspondents, I have had to report on turbulent events in Iran from the outside. Fortunately, 3 decades of reporting experience inside the country means I can call Iranians I trust from the outside, in my case, London, to hear firsthand their tales of the tumult. And the last one here is from Ukraine, and Dominique Sogul wrote this. It is hard to ignore the bitter cold and frequent power cuts on a recent reporting trip to Ukraine. Batteries deplete rapidly, cars break down, and we eat meals while wrapped in blankets and hug hot water bottles to sleep. What we endure is peanuts compared with the soldier freezing in a trench or the family caring for their own without reliable power. Behind every warm handshake, every brave smile, there is the pain of loss. Loved ones killed in the war, and anecdotes of near-death experiences from a drone or missile strike, or mine. But amid the loss and fatigue, what stands out is an enduring resilience, a strong sense of purpose, and the instinct to hold on and help each other. And now for the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. It's entitled, When Can Federal Law Enforcement Use Force, and How Is It Investigated? 3 questions answered. Fatal shootings of 2 U.S. citizens in Minneapolis put spotlight on policies and constraints. This is written by the duo of Henry Gass and Victoria Hoffman, who are both staff writers. The deaths of Renee Good and Alex Pretty in Minneapolis have raised questions about the constraints on the use of lethal force by federal law enforcement officers in an American city and how fatal shootings are investigated. On January 7th, Jonathan Ross, an officer with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, shot Ms. Good through the window of her car as she started driving away. On January 24th, officials with Customs and Border Protection shot Mr. Pretty after tackling him as he filmed their actions with his cell phone. The government has said those involved in the shootings acted in self-defense. The shootings, recorded in real time by bystanders on their cell phones, spread quickly on social media. The videos appear to contradict statements from Trump administration officials that the 2 U.S. citizens engaged in acts of domestic terrorism and sparked protests in cities across the country. President Donald Trump dispatched his border czar, Tom Homan, to Minneapolis in late January to de-escalate tensions. On January 29th, Mr. Homan raised the possibility of a drawdown of federal law enforcement based on stronger immigration enforcement cooperation with local authorities. He noted that federal agents who don't uphold standards of integrity, professionalism, and compassion will be dealt with. That followed calls from an increasing number of Republican lawmakers for impartial investigations into the two incidents. Now, what follows is a question and answer piece. Question: when is the use of lethal force acceptable and when is it not? Answer: the use of lethal force by state, federal, or local officers is governed by the Fourth Amendment, which protects individuals from unreasonable searches and seizures. U.S. Supreme Court rulings have defined the use of lethal force as seizure, meaning it can be legally justified in certain circumstances. Two Supreme Court cases define that standard. Tennessee v. Garner in 1985 set the precedent that an officer may not use deadly force on a suspect who is fleeing unless the officer is under a direct threat. Building upon that precedent, Graham v. Connor in 1989 held that an officer's actions are assessed based on objective reasonableness, considering what an officer's most reasonable judgment would be in a moment without the benefit of hindsight. Justice Department guidelines for its officers state that they may use force only when no reasonably effective, safe, and feasible alternative appears to exist, and may use only the level of force that a reasonable officer on the scene would use under the same or similar circumstances. And in parentheses, all federal law enforcement agencies were required, beginning in 2024, to adopt guidelines that match or exceed DOJ policy, close parentheses. The use of deadly force requires that the officer is facing a threat to their life in that specific moment, not merely weighing the potential of a future threat, attempting to flee, or engaging in a verbal altercation, according to Brandon Garrett, a professor at Duke University School of Law. Cases in which lethal force is deemed unusual occur if the officer violates safety protocol, such as not identifying themselves as law enforcement, using force against a fleeing suspect, firing warning shots, or placing themselves directly in harm's way. Using lethal force is reliant upon an officer's assessment of whether a subject will cause legitimate harm. In the two Minneapolis cases, administration officials have argued that the officers did face imminent threats. Ms. Good was behind the wheel of a car and had started driving. Mr. Pretty had been lawfully carrying a concealed handgun, which made him more of a threat to CBP officers, administration officials have argued. "You can't walk in with guns," President Trump said January 27th. But if a law enforcement officer is feeling threatened, there are still steps that they're supposed to take before using lethal force. Lots of people have cars. Lots of people are allowed to have firearms in this country. Just because a person has a weapon does not mean that they pose a deadly threat to you, says Professor Garrett. You absolutely are supposed to use verbal warnings and assess whether the person actually poses a deadly threat. It can't just be preventative. Question: are there differences in the application of lethal force between federal and local law enforcement agencies? Answer: while all law enforcement officers are subject to the Fourth Amendment, accountability and training policies vary by agency. It's unclear, however, given events in Minneapolis so far, how those policies vary and the extent to which they're being followed. At a city council meeting in West St. Paul, Police Chief Brian Sturgeon told his constituents that ICE has a different playbook. "They have a playbook that I am not trained in," he added. "They have a playbook that we disagree with on some aspects." On paper, guidelines set by the Department of Homeland Security, which houses both ICE and CBP, reinforce the Supreme Court's reasonableness precedent. Courts allow for the fact that law enforcement officers are often forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving, states the DHS's policy outline that was last updated in 2023. An officer, the outline adds, shall only use the force that is objectively reasonable in light of the facts at the time force is applied. The latest revisions instruct that each DHS officer undergoes both de-escalation and use of force training annually. Agents are instructed to employ tactics that promote the safety of both officers and individuals making decisions that minimize risk. Officers are also instructed to avoid intentionally placing themselves in positions in which they have no alternative to using deadly force. Two CBP agents opened fire on Mr. Pretty, were placed on leave. It's unclear whether Mr. Ross has faced any internal discipline. And the final question, how is a fatal shooting by a federal law enforcement officer supposed to be investigated? And the final answer, states can prosecute federal officials, but under limited conditions. The Supremacy Clause of the Constitution holds that federal law preempts state laws when the two conflict. However, if a federal officer is found to be acting outside the bounds of their duties, state authorities can proceed with an investigation and, potentially, a prosecution according to the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. In practice, it has been difficult for state prosecutors to bring charges against federal officers or agents. In cases like the Minnesota shootings, investigations are typically carried out by state and federal agencies, experts say. However, Justice Department officials kicked state agencies out of the investigation into Ms. Good's death. After Mr. Pretty's shooting, state officials took unusual legal measures to secure evidence from the scene. The Justice Department has reportedly asked Homeland Security Investigations, a branch of ICE, to lead the Pretty investigations, with the FBI assisting in another departure from protocol. Minnesota lawmakers have raised concerns that federal investigations will not be fair and impartial. It's unclear if the officers involved will face criminal prosecution or even a civil lawsuit, but a thorough and independent investigation is important, not just for determining potential legal consequences, but for the law enforcement profession in general, legal experts say. All uses of force by any federal officers or any agency have to be documented and investigated, Professor Garrett says. They're also supposed to do a postmortem to figure out how to prevent it from happening again, he adds. And now we find ourselves in the Home Forum section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week there is an article and a poem, and I will read both. Here's the article. A student of the open road. For this globetrotter, travel is about the experiences. The more off the beaten track, the better. And this is written by Robert Close. When I ask others about their travels, they normally respond with a list of sights and activities. The Eiffel Tower, a boat ride on the Thames, the Grand Canyon. I always listen respectfully and with quiet appreciation while realizing that I seem to be wired differently. I love to travel, but I don't do so to complete a checklist. Rather, I venture out to see what I can learn about myself. For example, after I recently returned from Central America, someone asked me what I had seen. I didn't think I gave them the answer they were looking for when I replied. I missed a critical bus to a port city, so I hitchhiked with a man hauling garbage in his pickup, and I had to ride with the garbage. The experience taught me to remember to be grateful for favors offered. My friend's indulgent smile conveyed the message. Oh, you poor man. But I'm not a poor man. If anything, I'm a student of the open road, where I've learned that most people are helpful, kind, and curious about travelers. I've also learned that necessity sometimes prods me to do something a bit out of character. I realize that hitchhiking abroad or at home might appear risky to many people. And I suppose there is always an element of risk and unpredictability when engaging with strangers in strange lands. Having said this, there are also subtler ways than hitchhiking to experience self-revelation when traveling. Take cuisine, for example. Some years ago, I went to a remote village in Honduras that rarely received outsiders. My 15-year-old son accompanied me. The poverty was striking, but so was the sense of community. The entire village came out singing as we arrived. Then they slew and cooked a chicken, which they set down before us. Knowing that I was a vegetarian, my son smiled and said, "So what are you going to do now, Dad?" The answer was clear. Eat the chicken. It wasn't particularly easy to compromise my vegetarian principles, but faced with a gift of food so freely given from people who had a greater need of the chicken than I did, I dispensed with my orthodoxy and ate as the villagers looked on, nodding their approval. I also think of my first visit to Iceland, where I went to spend a summer working on a farm. No one in the family spoke English, and my Icelandic was limited to a few pleasantries. But one can get a tremendous amount of mileage out of thank you, and then they spell it T-A-K-K, and a smile. I discovered that this was the quickest way to endear people to me, and me to them. The upshot is that I have never returned from a trip in which I didn't learn something new about myself or where I didn't fortify a quality, flexibility, compromise, risk-taking, that needed re-emphasizing. On a recent outing with a dear friend who shares the same travel sensibilities, I learned about my friend's backpacking trip through France and Belgium. I listened patiently to his thoughtful reflections, and then I asked, "How do you think you grew as a person as a result of this experience?" He looked at me and said, "Thank you for that." What ensued was a conversation meager in travelogue details, but rich with information about how the trip had yielded insights into my friend's life path, his ability to think on his feet, and his interactions with the people he met. There is wonder in viewing travel as an exercise in self-discovery. I have been at it for a long time, and there is still so much of the world to explore. Now, where did I put that atlas? Okay, here is the poem. It's entitled Waiting, and it's written by Michael R. McDonough. At first, the sparrows living in the Charles de Gaulle Departures Terminal are hard to spot, perched high in the long, translucent dome. As you buy a gift box of macarons for someone at home, you hear their song, but you can't tell where the sound is coming from. Then a flutter catches your eye, and you see one short flight between high white beams, then another, then you can't believe how many. What are they all doing here? You survey the scene. Hundreds of tired travelers with long layovers lean their heads on their chairbacks and stare absently upward, eating macarons and watching the birds, waiting for their time to fly away. And now for the editorials. The audacity of Trump's choice for Fed chief. The U.S. Senate will soon grill Kevin Warsh as President Donald Trump's nominee to head up the nation's central bank starting in May. The position is one of the most powerful in Washington. The Federal Reserve, with its mandate from Congress to ensure stable prices and full employment, helps steer both the American and world economies, mainly by setting interest rates. Given that the Senate easily approved the former Wall Street lawyer 2 decades ago to sit on the bank's board as the Fed's youngest ever governor, it might not probe him hard on one of his most intriguing yet disputed ideas. Yet it should. Mr. Warsh maintains that Americans in their curiosity, ingenuity, freedom, equality, and collaboration are as important as the Fed in keeping inflation low. How? Their dynamism and their adaptability to failure can keep economic productivity at such a high level that it will sustain wage growth and act as a disinflationary force. During his adult life, Mr. Warsh has seen the internet and computers, then mobile phones, and now artificial intelligence help drive efficiency in private business. He says the Fed should focus more on keeping interest rates low for smaller companies to drive such innovation. His optimism about AI's potential is not widely shared. Its effects in destroying and creating jobs have yet to be seen. He admits the productivity gains will be uneven. But the United States is still ahead of China in adopting and perfecting AI, he says, allowing it to ride a productivity wave for the next 5 years. AI is special, he claims, because it has reduced the cost of curiosity to zero. The ease of finding and formulating ideas with AI will speed up discoveries in industry and science. What country is most likely to benefit most from the cost of curiosity being zero and the fruits of knowledge being as large as ever? I think it's the United States, Mr. Warsh told the financial technology company Avon. Breaking an inflationary mindset requires that individuals be curious and inventive in finding solutions. As he said in a 2009 speech during his last tenure at the Fed, "I have not lost confidence in the inherent innovation, creativity, and dynamism in the U.S. economy, nor have I lost confidence in the inherent good sense of our citizens." The next editorial is entitled Small Nations Bond Amid Big Power Politics. Canada's recent call for middle powers to act together amid big power politics has reverberated around the world. Yet for many small nations, the imperative for cooperation has been gaining momentum for years. In most cases, the initial impulse is economic growth. Southeast Asian nations, for example, recently discussed a unified visa system for visitors. Seamless access, the Philippines tourism chief said, will help the region benefit from each other's tourism flows. Getting to this point has taken decades of trust building through strengthening diplomatic and trade links. Elsewhere, initiatives in the Caribbean and in West Africa have sought to reduce barriers to regional movements of goods and people. These blocs are also establishing a shared security, often bolstered by cultural or kinship ties. This, in turn, has enabled coordinated responses to emergencies, such as a severe 2017 hurricane season or the thwarting of an attempted coup in a member country. Lately, four Caribbean nations have opted to bring their total population of 1 million people closer. Last October, Barbados, Belize, Dominica, and St. Vincent, and the Grenadines instituted free movement for citizens to live, work, and receive government services within all four countries. In a global climate of tighter borders and immigration clampdowns, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace describes the Caribbean move as a contrasting vision of regulating human mobility, approaching it as a driver of development and prosperity rather than as a drain on resources. This model of integration, however, is rooted in more than economic factors. As one regional official told The Guardian, it underscores deep bonds. We are virtually the same people. We have no historical animosities, and we are very similar culturally, he said. And in a region that experiences extreme weather, to quote Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, joint action is not naive multilateralism. It's building coalitions that work issue by issue with partners who share enough common ground to act together. In an address to the citizens of Barbados, Prime Minister Mia Mottley emphasized the dignity of small states in creating alliances that work for them. Of the decision to ease border restrictions, she said, "It is measured. It is managed. It is ours." My friends, Ms. Mottley added, in a world where many are building walls, the Caribbean must build bridges. We must not allow fear and insecurity to define us. And there's one more here. A better civic future for America's past. Americans are preparing to mark the 250th anniversary of the United States this year. It's an opportunity for self-reflection and potential unity around a remarkable story of national achievement and a recognition of all that still needs doing to fully realize the country's founding ideals. Two-thirds of Americans, the Pew Research Center reports, believe it is extremely or very important to publicly discuss the country's historical strengths and successes, as well as flaws and failures. Yet people still disagree on how to tell that story. The Trump administration, for example, has issued directives to federal parks and museums to remove signage that it views as not in alignment with the shared national values. The city of Philadelphia has filed a lawsuit against the Interior Department for removing exhibits referencing slavery at a former residence of George Washington. The city deems this an effort to whitewash American history. The exhibits were controversial in 2010 when they opened during the Obama administration. At the same time, according to a report by the center-left Progressive Policy Institute, recent historical scholarship has tended to present a one-sided and unrelenting negative portrait of the U.S., examining its moral failings but nothing about its virtues. Studying nearly 100 articles published in American Quarterly, a journal of the American Studies Association, the report found that 80% were critical of the U.S. and 20% neutral, and not one was positive. Ideally, the researchers said, scholars should seek to capture the whole of America, the challenges alongside the heroism, the slavery and segregation, but also freedoms and values that gave rise to civil rights movements. economic inequality with an understanding of how the country came to have the world's most vibrant economy. Their observation echoes counsel offered by President Barack Obama in 2015 during a speech honoring civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama. "To deny hard-won progress, our progress," Mr. Obama said, "would be to rob us of our own agency to do what we can to make America better." Attaining a balanced and balanced reckoning with U.S. history calls for a willingness to consider varied perspectives, especially from those whose stories and contributions have been ignored. But it would also need to avoid what one historian has described as reading the present into the past, judging and condemning history and historical figures by present-day norms and standards. Ultimately, coalescing around a shared history is about a civic purpose that goes beyond academic debate or disciplines. As late sociologist James Lowen observed, "We aren't just learning about the past to satisfy our curiosity. We are learning about the past to do our jobs as Americans." Well, we've got about a minute or so left, so I'll read some statistics from the Numbers in the News column. 63, that's the percentage of U.S. adults who say they have volunteered their time to a religious or nonprofit organization within the past year. That is up 7 percentage points from a pandemic-era low in 2021. 7, that's the number of Japanese-American soldiers who were posthumously promoted to officer ranks in late January after their deaths 8 decades ago while fighting for the U.S. during World War II. They were cadets, on track to become Army officers when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. At 2, that's the number of Chinese pandas that left Tokyo's Yuno Zoo in late January. Twins Zio Zio and Li Li were the last Chinese pandas in Japan. Their departure leaves Japan with no pandas for the first time in 50 years and signals rising tensions between the two countries. And 83, that's the amount of countries that have ratified the High Seas Treaty, an international pact to safeguard marine life. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.